Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do your congressional representatives spend their days? In addition to the floor votes and speeches that get so much attention, there is work to be done crafting and reviewing proposed legislation, serving constituent requests from the Home Office, committee meetings and strategy sessions, media relations, and given the two-year election cycle for House members, a whole lot of campaigning and fundraising in between. It's an extreme schedule, to be sure, averaging 70 hours a week when they're in Washington. And here to talk about how they prioritize are two members of the delegation serving North Texas. Congressman Michael Burgess is a Republican elected in 2003 to the 26th Congressional District, representing parts of Denton and Tarrant counties. He is chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade, and sits on the subcommittees on Health and Oversight and Investigations. He's a member of the Rules Committee and the Security-focused Helsinki Commission, and he founded and co-chairs the Congressional Health Caucus. Congressman Mark Vesey is a Democrat elected in 2012 to the 33rd Congressional District, representing parts of Dallas and Tarrant counties. He serves on the House Armed Services Committee and the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. He is also Assistant and Regional Whip. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having us on, Chris.
I want to start with the passage of Congressman Burgess's bill last week to overhaul the formula by which doctors are reimbursed for care provided to Medicare patients. The old sustainable growth rate is out. What made that so unpopular and what replaces it now?
You know, Chris, one of the things I've learned after being here a few years is if you're featured on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as a member of Congress, it's probably not a good thing.
Or a member of the media.
And this was one of the things that they talked about last week. Why did it take 18 years to – basically, the legislation was old enough to vote on itself by the time it came up for a vote. I have introduced a repeal of the sustainable growth rate formula every term that I've been in the Congress. It took a while for it to reach critical mass. It was unpopular, of course. When members go home, they hear from their doctors, but they hear from in a town hall meeting, and people say, "Hey, how come I turned 65 and I had to change my doctor because my doctor wouldn't see me any longer on Medicare?" So those are the things that begin to gather. The cumulative weight of those types of observations are what eventually leads to something, again, getting to that critical mass and getting passed. This one, we got a lot of work done in the last Congress. It got right up to the finish line but didn't quite get across it. There was some cleanup work that had to be done at the beginning of this Congress, but we all knew we had a deadline coming on March 31st, so it wasn't a surprise. It wasn't something that, it kind of came on us all at once. This was well advertised, this was coming, and thankfully we had gotten a lot of the policy part squared away last year and done in a bipartisan fashion on the committees of jurisdiction.
In a town where bipartisan seems mostly impossible, at least to those of us who are watching from home, this did get bipartisan support. You voted for it, Congressman Vesey, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
What was compromised on by both sides? I know that both sides have some things that they're not happy with, but what convinced you that it was worth accepting some things that you weren't crazy about in order to get this done?
You know what? Believe it or not, a lot of the things that Dr. Burgess talked about. I mean, going home, talking to doctors that will tell you, hey, I have a business to run, and in order for it to, and I have to be able to meet certain, standards to be able to see patients. And, you know, right now we can't do that with the way that Medicare is set up. And that's a big deal. And when you talk to seniors that say, you know, my doctor, you know, won't accept, you know, Medicare now. I mean, those types of stories are really, they're heartbreaking. And for me, it was easy. That's why I voted for it. The only people that ended up voting against it were a handful of, you know, kind of Tea Party, you know, type members. But it was very bipartisan legislation, and I'm glad that it finally passed.
Yeah, one of my big concerns coming into it was the entire bill was not offset. And I get that gave some people heartburn. I was actually worried at one point that no part of the bill would be offset, and to me that would have been far worse.
Excuse me for interrupting. It adds $141 billion to the federal deficit. Is that correct?
That's correct. And there were $60 to $80 billion in offsets that were created by changes, structural changes within Medicare. what's the cost of doing nothing? And you do have to balance that with the cost of acting. The cost of doing nothing meant that for the next 10 years, there would be last-minute patches that Congress would pass, as we've always done, and the result would be a price tag that was about $1 billion more than the price tag put on this legislation by the Congressional Budget Office. So in this case, oddly, the no-build scenario was more expensive than just going ahead and getting it fixed. And you do start with some structural Medicare reform, which many of us have thought has been an important concept for some time. So that that is now done. That is now accomplished. Are there other things that can happen in the future? Absolutely. And those on-ramps are wide for people who want to make changes in the system. In fact, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is obligated now to evaluate those changes that people are able to bring with metrics to demonstrate their savings. The Secretary of CMS now will have to look at those programs, and if they decline them, they also have to tell people why they're being declined.
Congressman Vesey, you recently introduced a bill to help students who are U.S. citizens apply for federal financial aid for college if their parents are not U.S. citizens, documented or otherwise. How did you realize this was a problem for students who have U.S. citizenship and were, in fact, born in this country?
No, absolutely. We talked to counselors in the 33rd Congressional District all around the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex that said that this is a big, big problem. It basically is a burden on parents whose kids are American citizens, like you said, when they go online through the FAFSA process. Then they're not able to continue on because they can't be given a PIN number. And it's unfair. I would like to, you know, continue to try to make this easier. I don't think there's anything more important that we can do as members of Congress than to make sure that all of our children have a good education, particularly when it comes to higher education. We know that kids that go on to college, that get a two-year or a four-year degree, that they're much more likely to stay employed, be able to take care of their family, own a home. Those are the things that all of us as members of Congress find important, and we want to try to enhance. And so that's why I filed this legislation. It's the right thing to do.
How did you both feel about the president's suggestion that perhaps we could find a way to make the first 2 years of college tuition-free for students?
And from my perspective, that is problematic. You know, we were just talking about the cost of offsetting this this relatively modest Medicare bill. That would be a much larger expense. And, you know, things are valuable to people if they work for them. Other countries do provide a college education at no cost. And yet, when people from those countries come and talk to us as a legislative body, it's how do you keep such an interest in your colleges? And it's not just the fact that we have owls and tigers that are our mascots. It's that people are invested in their college. They have invested in their education there, and they feel an ownership with the institution, even those institutions that may ultimately be state-supported for and tuition be partially subsidized. But you leave that, and again, I think it devalues the worth of a college education.
Dr. Burgess may be surprised about this, but I would actually tweak it some. I think that what the president is doing is taking us in the right direction. But, you know, why not expand that beyond community colleges? Like, for instance, just outside of my district, in the 30th Congressional District that Eddie Bernice Johnson represents, a good friend of mine, Michael Sorrell, he is the president of Paul Quinn College, a college that my wife graduated from. Let those colleges as well that are reaching out to kids, giving them opportunity to go to college, and in many ways like community colleges, they're reaching out to non-traditional students, and let them have an opportunity to also have their students go to college free for 2 years.
I wonder if you could both talk about the balance of keeping up with what is happening in your very busy jobs in Washington, D.C., and keeping up with day-to-day events back in the home district and what your process is for doing that.
No, that is a really, really good question. First of all, you know, having a young family like I have, I have a 9-year-old son, and making sure that I spend time at home, making sure that I'm helping my wife when I get back because she also has a very busy career as well. You know, that is obviously the number one priority. And the district staff does a great job of making sure that I get out and about in the district when I'm back. One of the things that I've really enjoyed doing is I work at a different place once a month. I call it Mark Means Business, where I actually go and like work at a different company that serves the 33rd Congressional District or is located within the district. So last week I delivered beer for Benny Keith, which is the Budweiser distributor in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. I've worked at taquerias, barbecue places. I deliver packages for UPS, and it really gives me a perspective on what it's like working for a large or a small business, and gives me the opportunity to really view how business works from the employer standpoint and the employee standpoint. And I've really learned a lot by doing that.
I think one of the decisions that I made when I first came up here was Washington is a workstation. I live in Denton County. And as a consequence, I go home every weekend. I know Mark does too. We see each other on the plains frequently after those last votes on Thursday or Friday, and then get up early on Monday or Tuesday. And American Airlines is always good to us. We're there the sort of the last person we see in the district and the first people we see up here in D.C. every week. But that is critical. And I think if I didn't go home every week, the part of the world that we represent is growing so fast that, a month away and I wouldn't know my way around back home anymore. It is critically important to be home every week. And even, yes, you have to do the things, and staff is very good about scheduling one event after another, but just going to the Home Depot or the Tom Thumb, you're going to run into constituents, and it's just important that they see you there doing everyday sort of things.
Are you familiar with the theory that some people have that the ability, because we have airplanes, of people to go back to their home districts so often means that there are fewer opportunities for collegial relationships, particularly across parties today, because people don't stay in Washington, D.C. for much of the session. They're back home.
Yes, I'm familiar with the concept. I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to it. I think the opportunities for collegiality are there. Requires a little bit of work, whether you're staying in Washington over the weekend or going home for your district.
I think it makes it really tough to build the relationships when we're only here, really two full days a week, if you really think about it. I mean, we normally come in, let's say on a Monday, we leave on Thursday, and we work Tuesday and Wednesday. And, Thursday, we're usually back on the plane, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, heading back to our districts. It is about building relationships. That makes it tough. But with that said, I don't think that there's ever any going back to the old days. I went and talked with Jim Wright, who was Speaker of the House from Fort Worth, also Majority Leader. And I, right before I got sworn in, I asked him about that. And he said, yeah, he told me that he thinks that it definitely makes a difference in the collegiality between, colleagues. He had very strong relationships with Republicans. But, we live in a new world. And so I think that the way that it's set up now, that it works. And, but we still do need to figure out ways that we can, get together more, talk more, work in a bipartisan manner. So we're not seeing each other as, the evil liberals versus the evil conservatives.
We are speaking this hour with two members of the congressional delegation that serve North Texas. Congressman Mark Vesey represents the 33rd District. He's a Democrat. Congressman Michael Burgess represents the 26th. He's a Republican. We'll resume our conversation with them in a few minutes. And if you would like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Don't forget our Tumblr feed that we have going. There are pictures of the action taking place right now as we are here in Washington, D.C. You can find that at think.tumblr.com. We'll be back to the show in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about representing North Texas in Congress, since we are having Think's Week in Washington, D.C. at the headquarters of NPR. My guests for the hour are Congressman Michael Burgess of the 26th Congressional District. He's a Republican. And Congressman Mark Vesey of the 33rd Congressional District. He is a Democrat. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. I was reading a survey of time and how congressional representatives spend their time. Apparently, it's 70 hours a week when you are here in the district. Is that accurate approximately for both of you much of the time?
You know, I've never put a pencil to paper. I've got a very active committee schedule, very active subcommittees. The Rules Committee keeps me going in the evenings. So, I mean, it's you know, most days it just seems like there's always something going on from start to finish.
Yeah, very long days. I never have really thought about how long the days may be. But, yeah, work very long days. And, you know, and oftentimes you're working so quickly, so fast that, you know, nightfall will be here and you don't even realize it.
What's the process for digesting legislation that you may not have authored, but you're going to have to vote on? How do you know exactly what's in the bills that you'll be called upon to decide? What's the role of staff? What's the role of lobbyists? How do you decide?
You know, I can't speak for the committee that Dr. Burgess is on, but like, for instance, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and the committee staff does an outstanding job of, when we have our committee hearings, of putting together a synopsis of different pieces of legislation, history of, you know, how we got to the point to where we are now. And the information is so concise, but so good and thorough at the same time. And I can't say enough about the staff that work on these committees, which, you know, the legislation will normally flow through the committees before it ultimately makes it to the floor, which is what you normally will see on C-SPAN. And the work that they do is outstanding and really makes it easy to understand as a member of Congress.
Yeah, staff, both in personal office and at the committee level, staff do a great job. We also have the Congressional Research Service that we can ask to look into the history of an issue for us, and that is very helpful. And then I just got to tell you, being on the Rules Committee, where every major piece of legislation that's going to come to the floor of the House and be voted on under a rule, I get to hear from the chairman and ranking member of the Committee of Jurisdiction as that piece of legislation comes to the Rules Committee. So for me, the past two terms, that has been an additional way to become informed about the bills, the people that are opposed, the problems that they have, and then the amendments, both pro and con, that are offered at the level of the Rules Committee. So that's been sort of, if you will, another check on me. The standard, though, of course, is to read the bill. And sometimes it does mean you stay up late at night and leaf through a bill. That can be hard because, as you know, these things are not written in English. And, okay, we're amending Title 18 of the Social Security Act of whatever. And because the bill is written in amending an existing statute, if you don't have the existing statute in front of you, sometimes it's hard to know just exactly what the issue is. So it makes it a little tougher. And again, Mark's correct. That's where staff can come in and fill in some of those gaps and make that process a great deal more straightforward.
How do you both balance the obligations that you feel to all of the residents of your districts, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, whether they voted for you or not, those obligations with the obligations that you have to the party that helped you get elected and whose ideas you align yourself with, and how often are they in conflict?
Well, they can be. And I don't know if you're aware of this fact, but actually, Mark has a congressional district that I used to have a portion of, the east side of the city of Fort Worth, or the southeast side. And clearly the politics of that part of the city of Fort Worth are different from the politics that I came with to Congress. Still, my obligation was to represent all citizens of the district. So at that point, I had a district that went from Gainesville, Texas, up on the Red River, down to the southern Tarrant County line. It was pretty long and narrow, but it was my obligation to show up. Now, may not have agreed on things, but I certainly made it my commitment in the southeast part of Fort Worth that I would be focused on education, that I would be focused on employment, I would be focused on economic development. And indeed, we did do an economic development summit every fall that usually took place on the campus of Texas Wesleyan University. And as I drive through parts of east and southeast Fort Worth now, you know, it's a little bit of pride because there's some things going on, and the seeds for those were laid several years ago. And as a consequence, I think we moved the needle, certainly from the employment and the economic development standpoint in that part of Fort Worth. But I also had an obligation to the folks up in Gainesville, Texas, who were probably politically as diametrically polar opposites to the good people in southeast Fort Worth. And I had an obligation to show up in both places and do my best to represent both constituencies.
You know what? That's a great question. And, you know, what I've found by, you know, having the various events in my district, whether I'm working in the district like I talked about earlier, I'm doing a Congress on your corner or a town hall meeting. And take one neighborhood in my district in East Fort Worth, the Woodhaven neighborhood, where you have a lot of retirees that are, you know, financially, you know, well off. And you talk with them and you talk to a single, you know, grandmother that's that's basically a single mom raising her grandson. And, you know, they'll tell you the same thing that the person, the retired well-off couple in the Woodhaven area will tell you, that they're worried about the economy. They're worried about issues like transportation, education, even if they already have kids that have left the roost or left the house. You know, they're concerned about, you know, what are future prospects for their kids or their grandkids. And so all of those things are important. So I think that people really agree more often than people, you know, than it sometimes is portrayed in the media. And what I will say is that I always try to, you know, remember that, you know, that I'm a Texan. And if I can put the values that were instilled in me by my family and by the roots that I have as a Texan, then I think that I'll do all right. I mean, you do have to think about, you know, the various, you know, politics. Obviously, that is important, especially with me, you know, being a Democrat in this district that is a majority Democratic district. But I always try to do what's right first, and always try to remember that I'm a Texan that has been instilled with good values.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Morgan on the line in Louisville. Hello, Morgan. Oh, Morgan, are you with us? Okay, we lost Morgan. How often do you all and other members of the North Texas delegation get together to talk about things that are of local and regional interest that you may work on across party lines, and how do those communications go?
Ideally, there's a bipartisan meeting once a month. It's generally organized by our senior senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison. Previously was the one to pretty much drive that. Senator Cornyn takes on that obligation now. You know, so many of us are so busy throughout the day that oftentimes that's one of the things that drops off the schedule. I can't speak for Mark, but I know the Republicans in the Texas delegation, and we are, if I may modestly say, the largest Republican delegation in the House of Representatives. We meet each Thursday afternoon at noon and do talk about things that are important to the delegation, to the state, things that are happening in each of our individual committees that might be important to other members of the delegation. But there is a pretty strong sense of cohesion on those Thursday meetings. Now, Senator Cornyn had an office meeting late last week. There were members from both parties there, but lightly attended because at the end of a busy day. And Senator Hutchison used to do those early in the day, and again, about a once-a-month schedule. But they're same problem that you would run into, that people are oversubscribed already, even at 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes it's difficult to make those meetings. But I don't think there's any hesitation, certainly none on my part, to talk to a member of the delegation on the floor, Republican or Democrat. Mark, Henry Cuellar, frequently will come over to where we're sitting on the Texas row on the Republican side and share ideas and gossip and whatever else is the sort of the coin of the realm. I think there is a good working relationship between members of the delegation really on a day-to-day basis.
Remember from your question earlier, I mentioned that we were really only here two full work days a week. We're here Tuesday normally when we start on Monday, we're here all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday. And so being able to fit every meeting into those 2 days with your committee hearing, with votes on the House floor, that is very tough. And you know, our Democratic delegation meets just like the Republican Texas delegation does. But I think that we should be meeting, you know, more often when we can, just because some of the issues that are so important, you know, education and how technology is changing our workforce, particularly in the Tarrant County area. We have a lot of great manufacturers, like the Lockheed Martins, the Bell Helicopters, people that have employed, you know, thousands of people literally at one time. And those work shops are starting to change. The manufacturing floor is starting to change. There's more technology. So there are educational issues that I think that we need to be able to deal with as members of Congress that will make sure that those workforces are protected and those jobs are protected for future generations to come. Also, transportation. I mean, the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is one of the most dynamic, one of the fastest growing areas in the entire country. And, you know, right now we don't have enough money to meet all of our transportation needs. We don't have enough money for new roads. We don't have enough money to repair the existing infrastructure that we already have. You know, a lot of people say, well, we can, you know, do more managed lanes, more toll roads. You know, that's not a good long-term solution. Those are the types of things as members of the delegation, particularly the North Texas delegation, that we probably should be talking about more. But with the 2 days a week that we are here, it's very, very tough. You know, I would like to see more of us like sitting down, working together, you know, someone saying, okay, you guys get together in a room and don't come out. And do you have a solution? I think that will probably be good for Texans. I know it would be good for North Texas.
How do you assess the content of the, I'm imagining it's sort of a flood of emails and constituent letters that you receive. Do you have any idea how many it is in a particular week or month?
We hit a high water mark in 2010, and I think it was in excess of 70,000 letters and emails for that year.
Goodness.
It has fallen off then somewhat, but not by a lot. So there is still a vast amount of information that comes in that's incoming into the office with either telephone calls or emails. I get a log of all the telephone calls that come in every day, and that is prepared for me, both the district office and the Washington, D.C. office, so that I can see who's called in about what, and then weekly reports on the emails and the snail mail letters that have come in. And certainly if we've got a critical issue coming up, like the TARP bill a few years ago, then it's extremely important for me to stay in touch with staff. You know, what are we hearing? What are we hearing from within the district? And in the case of that, it was like 4,000 to 1, don't do this. So that actually reinforced a position that I already had. So that was a good thing. But it is important to stay up with the information coming from the district.
You know, in one of my previous lives, I was a congressional staffer. And, you know, when I was back, you know, back then, back in the old days, back in 1998, 1999, basically whenever the member of Congress that I worked for would get messages in, it was phone calls and mail. Like, that was like it.
Somebody had a notebook and they took.
Right, exactly. And it's just really amazing how much, you know, that has changed. Now people reach out to you on your official Facebook. People reach out to you on your private personal Facebook. You know, through other forms of social media, and being able to keep up with all of that is definitely a challenge, but it's important to do. And I think that people do a really good job of reaching out. I know that particularly when we have major issues that come up, that we get calls from all over the district. We get a variety of different opinions on how I should be voting on a particular issue, and we try to, you know, keep up with all of that and make sure that we even send the people, whether it is through email or whether it's through Facebook or whether they do a more traditional means and they write in or call in. We try to make sure that we respond back in some fashion or another. But people are out there really watching what we're doing.
Well, you've both answered with lots of great detail, and I appreciate that. What I want to know is, for people who wish to contact their member of Congress, is there a particular kind of communication? Is there, what causes, let's just say, a letter from a constituent to really stick with you, to definitely find its way to your desk and to be part of your thinking, not as part of a tide of people saying vote this way or don't vote that way, but as an individual piece of communication?
Well, it's typically casework that comes, and one of the concerns that I have with people who do like to communicate on Facebook, that may not be the best way to communicate to me that you're having a problem with the VA. It much better to make a phone call or to do a formal constituent inquiry, and that's, I'm much more likely to be able to help than some anonymous posting on a Facebook or a tweet. But those are the letters that sort of rise in the level of importance. I ask my staff to prepare a summary for me every week of everything that's going on in the district office. Casework is a big part of that. But if we've gotten notification, as we did 2 weeks ago, income tax filing day came around, people would go to file their taxes online, be declined because, hey, that has already been filed. There'd been some identity theft, and we got a number of calls about that. I did an outreach to the district and said, look, if you're having trouble, let us know and let us help you with the IRS if they're not responding to your concerns quickly enough. They're pretty good about straightening things out. They're not very good about doing it in a timely fashion. I think the average is like 254 days that it takes the IRS to actually right the wrong. Ultimately, that person will get their tax refund, but it may take longer because of this identity theft problem. So we do try to stay on top of things like that and react quickly when issues come to the surface like that.
That's Congressman Michael Burgess of the 26th Congressional District. We will come back and get an answer from you, Congressman Vesey, in just a minute. We're going to take a break. Congressman Vesey represents the 33rd District. We're talking about the realities of representing North Texas in the United States Congress. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also check out our Tumblr feed that is available online at kerathink.tumblr.com. Check it out.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. We are talking to you today from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guests this hour are Congressman Michael Burgess and Congressman Mark Vesey. They are members of the delegation representing North Texas in the U.S. Congress. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And Congressman Vesey, I was asking you earlier, what causes a particular communication to really stand out for you?
You know, what causes a particular communication to stand out for me is when I go back out into the district and I'm doing events and what have you, and someone can, you know, will stop me and say, hey, I'm the person that wrote to you about this particular issue I was having. You know, one of the things that we do is we do an event called Congress on Your Corner, and we do a Congress on Your Corner edition where I actually get on a city bus and I ride the bus and I pass out information about the congressional office and take questions from people while I'm riding on the city bus at the Fort Worth Transportation Authority.
There's no escaping at that point, right? You're on the bus, yeah, you're going to take those questions.
Exactly. And I was on a bus route on the north side of Fort Worth near the Stockyards area. And there was a lady in there that said, I want to thank you because I'd written you a letter about an issue I was having with Social Security. And your office helped me, and they helped me successfully. And I really, really appreciated that. And so being able to go out in public and tie that person back to a letter that was written to your office, I think that makes like a huge difference for me. It just sort of adds a personal touch to it. And I think it's a great way to, you know, for me to just to stay in touch is to try and keep up with as much of the casework as possible and get updates on it. So I'll know what people are going through and what some of the issues that they're facing as we, you know, deal with pieces of legislation that relate to those various departments where they may be having these issues as members of Congress.
You have to raise a lot of money to win a seat in Congress. You have to run for Congress every 2 years. There have been estimates that as much as a fifth to a third of the amount of time that congressional representatives spend in those long weeks we talked about is about politics, meaning campaigning and fundraising. Does the amount of fundraising you have to do interfere with the amount of time that you have to do the business of crafting and voting on legislation?
I would say that that we do spend too much time fundraising. I mean, fundraising here in D.C. Is a reality. I would certainly welcome more, you know, rules or laws to sort of curtail the amount of money that's in politics. I don't think it's a good thing, but the reality is that it's here. And members of Congress that want to get reelected know that they have to raise money. It's really unfortunate that it is such a big part of what we do here. But the reality is that it is, and I don't think that it's going to change anytime soon.
Well, I've never been known as a prolific fundraiser. I do what is necessary to raise the funds in order to run a competent and successful reelection campaign.
Everybody needs money.
Right. And you have obligations that that your party will put upon you. And as you ascend higher in your hierarchy on the committees, there are perhaps more demands that are placed upon you for participation in those types of things. But my impression is the amount of time spent fundraising, at least in my office, is manageable. It's not an overwhelming demand upon time. Again, I'm sure there's people on my staff who think you need to be a little more focused on this, sir. But I do what's necessary, and raising money has never been my strong suit. It probably never will be.
Congressman Vesey, there is a case with your name on it being argued before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals today. You believe I'm generalizing here, but it's unconstitutional for the state of Texas to require voters to show a state-issued ID before they cast a ballot.
It's really more than that.
Okay.
It's about just the burden that is put on the voter. I mean, if you look back at the history of voting in this country, and you look to where we are today versus, you know, the mid-1960s when the Voting Rights Act was passed, you know, now more than ever, there's been more of a burden put upon the voter. And so, like, for instance, let's say that your driver's license is 61 days expired, then, and you go to vote, you get to cast a provisional ballot that doesn't vote unless you make an effort to go back up to the county courthouse and bring your valid ID in. And let's say that you're having trouble making ends meet, then you have to go and get a birth certificate to be able to get the proper identification or the voter ID card. So there's just a lot of burden that is put up on voters, and that was the reason why I became a plaintiff in this lawsuit. In addition, I mean, all along the way, there have been judges, Republican appointees and Democratic appointees, that have said that this particular voter ID bill is so onerous and that it puts such a burden on voters that it's discriminatory. And I don't think that is good to have that kind of discrimination in place in Texas. And so I think that we'll be successful. I'm confident. I don't know what's going to happen at the Fifth Circuit, but, you know, we plan to go as far as we can with this because we feel that we have a great case and that, again, that the Texas voter ID law in particular is discriminatory. That is blatantly discriminatory.
Do you expect it to go to the Supreme Court?
We'll see what happens along each step of the way. I don't want to make any predictions because you never know which way these judges are going to go. But I would say that, only accepting, you know, a handful of forms of ID, let's say a young person that graduates from one of our state universities, Texas A&M or University of Texas, even those state IDs, those won't even count. It's a law that was put in place to skim just enough voters off the top So if there is a close election, that minority voters' vote won't count as much as others, and I think that's a big problem.
Congressman Burgess, you're not a party to the lawsuit, but I know you have a position on the issue.
Sure. Well, first off, let me just point out how Governor Abbott, who was successful in the last election, got probably, what, a million more votes than his Democratic counterpart. So whatever you think about this issue, I don't think skimming votes was a problem. Look, when I don't do a lot of polling, but I do a poll every fall. So I call it my benchmark poll. And this is one of the questions that I've polled over the last 10 years, and it's been pretty consistent. Even in districts that tend to be more Democratic precincts, this is an 80% issue. It's a 99% issue in more Republican precincts, but people feel that you ought to be able to provide a picture ID to be able to vote. And this is not a foreign concept. It's not something that is different from what people's expectations are. You show a picture ID to cash a check. You show a picture ID to buy a package of cigarettes. Why not show a picture ID to vote? And again, the concept is one that is actually pretty uniformly accepted throughout North Texas.
We are speaking this hour with Congressman Michael Burgess and Congressman Mark Vesey. We have an email here from Joey in Denton. This question, I believe, is for both of you. Joey says, being that lobbyists have incredible influence in what we as constituents see coming out of Congress, should there be more transparency between what is solely a congressional decision versus what is presented almost verbatim from lobbyists, meaning, I suppose, legislation that is suggested by members of particular lobbies. I'm assuming, Joey, that that's what you mean, and perhaps you could answer the question that way.
Well, of course, there are laws regarding if anyone who presents themselves to lobby a member of Congress does have to file certain forms to actually address that transparency issue. I'll just say as a practical matter, and maybe it's because I'm pretty set in my ways, I just don't get a lot of time spent on me with those types of issues. Anyone has the ability to petition their government. That is a First Amendment right that all of us possess. So I hear from mayors, I hear from city council people. Are they technically lobbying? Perhaps so, but under the Constitution, they have the right to come to my office and talk to me about whatever issue it is that they want to discuss.
I mean, every member of Congress gets lobbied on a variety of different issues, and sometimes it's a lobbyist. Sometimes it's a lobbyist that is leading a group of people that from an organization that they represent. You may have a lobbyist from a community college district, and they may have the students come into your office that attend the community college to lobby you on an issue that the lobbyist is trying to promote. And so you have to take all of that information that you get, whether it's from a lobbyist, whether it's from a member of an association, whether it's from a mayor or a city council person or a county commissioner, and weigh all of that information as best as possible and come up with a particular decision. But everybody it comes to a member of Congress to ask and make their opinion heard one way or the other.
When we are home watching C-SPAN, we can see a lot of speeches that are made by members of the House. I know this all gets recorded permanently. How often are people actually sitting there paying attention, listening, and willing to have their perception of a particular issue influenced by the speeches that get made?
It depends on when in the debate the speech occurs. Now, if you're watching C-SPAN late at night and we're doing special orders, there's probably not, and I've used this as a theatrical maneuver, there's not a dry eye in the House right now. Well, in fact, there's no other eyes in the House but mine because I'm speaking to an empty chamber. If we are doing something that is fairly contentious, you'll see us do appropriations bills over these next several weeks, and there'll be a number of amendments. Some of those will be late at night where there won't be many people on the House floor. But if a vote is requested, we'll all have to vote on that issue and become familiar with it. But then as the debate wraps up, as the bill gets close to the point we're going to vote on passage, the House will have a great deal more people in the seats listening to the debate as it goes on. make no mistake about it, if there's something that I think is important going on the floor, but I have meetings in my office, I will have C-SPAN going in the background. So if someone like Mark gets up to make a speech, I'm apt to turn the sound up to hear what he's going to say, make sure he's not saying something defamatory about me.
Would never do that, Dr. Burgess.
Are you paying attention? Are you willing to be swayed by what's happening on the floor?
I'm a great listener. I consider myself a really, really good listener. But what I will say is that oftentimes what you don't see when you're watching C-SPAN goes back to what Dr. Burgess has said. There may be a debate on a particular bill that's going on the House floor, and I may be sitting in Armed Services Committee. I may not even know that the debate is going on at that time period. I may be sitting in Science, Space, and Technology Committee. There could be a constituent in the office that I talked about, that two-day window that we really have to get everything done. There could be a constituent in my office, you know, come in to talk with me about a particular, you know, issue, or an employer in the district talking about a particular issue. And so those opportunities to actually sit on the House floor and just have time to just sit and listen are very rare. But when we are on the House floor and there is, a motion that takes place that allows us to listen to a debate for 10 minutes, then I would say that a lot of members are listening and trying to hear if there's some detail or something that they may have missed during a caucus meeting or during a briefing that may make them look at the situation differently.
Okay, I want to go quickly to this, but Congress has as of a few months ago, a 15% approval rating, which is to say an 85% disapproval rating. To the extent, I mean, you don't want to take it personally, but why do you think Americans are so dissatisfied with the performance of the body of the U.S. Congress?
I think it's the partisanship that is on display 24 hours a day now. Back in the old days, people watch Walter Cronkite, maybe see if they can catch, a quick 2 or 3 minutes of what was going on in Congress from their local news, so back home, channel 4, 5, 8, or 11. But now people see more partisanship, and they see more of it all the time. And the Congress is probably more partisan now than it has perhaps been before, just because of the nature of redistricting in our country. You have more and more members of Congress that come from either a very Democratic district or a very Republican district. We have 36 congressional districts in the state of Texas, and in 2012 and 2014, there was one of those districts were contested in the fall. And you're seeing that story played out more and more around the country. And so I think that the over-partisanship that goes on here probably turns people off.
Congressman Mark Veazey is a Democrat elected in 2012 to the 33rd Congressional District. Congressman Michael Burgess is a Republican elected in 2003 to the 26th Congressional District. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to have you both here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us on, Chris.
Our think team in Washington includes Stephen Becker, Jeff Whittington, and Rick Holter. Thanks to all the people from NPR who have made this week possible. We also want to thank the folks at KERA in Dallas, Lindsay Connect, Shelley Canavy, and Kristen Taylor. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. This week, you can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC and get a look at behind-the-scenes action on our new Tumblr. It's at kerathink.tumblr.com. If you'd like to contact the show via email, as always, it's think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd in Washington this week. Thanks for listening and have a great day.